and welcome to episode 63 of our podcast called Two Chairs Talking. I'm one of the talking chairs, and my name is David Grigg. The other talking chair is Perry Middlemiss. How are you, Perry?
Good, thanks, David.
Very good, as a talking chair. I have a question for you, Perry.
Yep.
What do you know about St. Wiborada?
Zero.
Ah, well, it seems that St. Wiborada is the patron saint of libraries and bibliophiles. And I came across an interesting little story about her and how she came to be that saint in a book called The Library, A Catalogue of Wonders by Stuart Kell, which I will probably talk about on the podcast in the future. But the basic story behind St. Wiborada is that in sort of the 900s, I think, AD, the Abbey of St. Gall in eastern Switzerland had a prized library of manuscripts. And Wiborada was a reclusive nun living nearby, and she had a premonition that the library was in danger, and she advised the monks to remove the library to an even safer place than the abbey that we're in, the island of Reichenau on Lake Constance. And when the invaders came, the monks sought refuge in a nearby fortress, but Wiborada, the nun, remained in her reclusive cell, and she was killed by the intruders. She became, in 1047, the first woman in the history of the church to be canonized. And today she's honoured as the patron saint of libraries and bibliophiles, as I said. Interesting stuff. Interesting stuff.
Good. So there you interesting, go. Interesting story.
Indeed. So apart from that, how have you been?
Not too bad. Just trucking along as we normally are, doing a lot of reading, bit of writing, bit of a few reviews, that sort of stuff here and there. Standard sort of thing, David. One sort of week. One week just sort of rolls into
blends
the next.
Into another, doesn't it?
It does.
So this episode, we're going to be talking about two books which we have both read and have opinions on. So we'll have a bit of a discussion about them. So we have some news, don't we? The Nobel Prize for Literature.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, the 2021 Nobel Prize for Literature has been announced during this last week, and the winner is Abdulrazak Gurnah, who's a Tanzanian author who immigrated from that country to the United Kingdom in the late 1960s. He was most recently Professor of English and Postcolonial Literatures at the University of Kent in Canterbury until he retired recently. Mm. Gurnah is the first black African author to have won the award since Wole Soyinka in 1986. Now, his novel, which I shall hold up to the camera so that only David can see, his novel Paradise was shortlisted for the Booker Prize in 1994. Uh-huh. I think I bought this not long after. It was shortlisted. And guess what? I've never read it. So I decided...
Now's your excuse.
I decided I'd better pull it out and have a bit of a look at it, so to see how that goes. But I've got a question for you, David.
Ah, go ahead.
Science fiction writers and fantasy writers, yes, and the Nobel Prize, or let us say writers who have written in the genres of science fiction and fantasy and the Nobel Prize, how many do you reckon you could identify?
I could identify zero, I would think.
Oh, okay.
If I looked at the list, I would probably recognise a name or two.
Probably recognise a few. Well, would I tell you that if I reckon there's probably about 10?
Wow. That's pretty good.
So I'll just give you a quick run through.
Sure.
Rudyard Kipling, 1907.
Right.
The Jungle Books.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, and some fantasy and some horror. Mm. Anatole France, 1921. Mm. He wrote a book called Penguin Island in 1908, which satirises human nature by depicting the transformation of penguins into humans and concludes with a dystopian future.
Whoa.
George Bernard Shaw.
Man and Superman, is that?
Man and Superman, 1903. A play has a section with Don Juan in hell.
Mm. Yeah, sort of fantasy. Yeah.
Sort of fantasy, but near enough. I mean, it's not realistic fiction, though, is it?
No, that's true. It's true.
Sinclair Lewis, this is the classic one at the moment, because 1930, his novel It Can't Happen Here, which was written after he received the award in 1935, is a dystopian political novel that some have said have predicted the rise of Donald Trump in the United States. Herman Hesse,
yes.
Yeah, 1946, wrote The Glass Bead Game, published in 1943. Mm-hmm. Now, here's one that's a bit of a stretch, Winston Churchill.
Ooh, yes.
In 1953, he won the Nobel Prize, mainly, I think, for his...
histories?
Big non-fiction work, History of the English-Speaking Peoples.
Yes.
But he did actually write a counterfactual history called If Lee Had Not Won the Battle at Gettysburg in 1931.
Uh-huh.
So that was actually... he wrote that as a section of an anthology of counterfactuals. A bit of a stretch, but...
Not bad.
And now we get into some that are a bit more recent. 1974, Harry Martinson, who I'd never heard of before, his poem Eniara consists of 103 cantos and relates the tragedy of a spacecraft which, originally bound for Mars with a colony of colonists from the ravaged Earth, is ejected from the solar system after an accident.
Interesting.
That's not science fiction, I've done it.
That's definitely science fiction.
1983, William Golding...
Oh, yes, yes, for sure.
Now, he deserves almost, it. Lord of the Flies, maybe, and his novella Envoy Extraordinary, or Extraordinary, depending on how you want to pronounce it, was published in a collection of three novellas along with John Wyndham and Mervyn Peake.
Okay, yeah, sure. I can understand.
I've got a copy of that around here somewhere. And I think that Golding also published a number of early science fiction short stories.
Okay, yeah. You could argue that Pinscher Martin is fantasy, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Doris Lessing, 2007.
Yes, fair enough.
Well, she was guest of honour at the 1987 Worldcon in Brighton. And best known for her Canopus in Argos series of novels. Very definitely science fiction. And the most recent, in 2017, Kazuo Ishiguro. Who has written Never Let Me Go, The Buried Giant, and most recently, Clara and the Sun.
Mm.
Now, I make that near 10.
10.
There might well be others. I mean, I did see a report that an Icelandic author, Laknes, very early Nobel Prize winner. I think he possibly wrote some fantasy as well. But anyway, so there's at least 10 or so.
But. Why did Jorge Luis Borges never get the Nobel?
Very good question.
Mm.
Very good question. There's a whole lot of people that never got it. And he lived for quite a long period of time.
Tolstoy never got it either. And he was eligible.
No, H.G. Wells did never get it.
No.
Sometimes you get some people that get it and you go, what? I mean, even ones that you might know their work and you think, what? Anyway, so look, it's all a bit of a, it's all a bit weird and all a bit up in the air. And there have been a few scandals about the Nobel Prize for Literature over the last couple of years as well. So hopefully that's all been straightened out. And at least this year they've decided that they are going to give it to a black African and only the second one. Of course, Australia's only ever had one, that being Patrick White. I believe that there's two or three that are sort of in contention. 4 or 5 years ago, odd enough, Gerard Manane was being touted as being high up on the rankings. Les Murray was always there, but he's now died, so you can't get it posthumously.
No.
You must be alive to receive it. So, you know. We'll just have to see what happens.
Indeed.
But I think we have a tendency to get lumbered in with the European countries, and there's a fair push for more non-European or non-US recipients. And you can understand that because there's been quite a lot for those particular countries over the years. But anyway.
Oh, there you go.
So that's my news. It's always big news to have the Nobel Prize coming up each year. It's always fun to speculate and then argue the toss about it.
That's right.
It's like every other prize winning novel or novelist.
Indeed. All right, so should we roll on to the books we've been reading?
Yes, we will. And I actually am going to be dealing with a prize winner first up. Mine is The Bass Rock by Evie Wilde, which was published, it's an Australian novel published in 2020, although it's not set in Australia. This is the winner of the 2021 Stella Prize, which, as we've discussed, is for works by Australian women authors. Interestingly enough, though, although this won the Stella Prize, it actually is not eligible for the Miles Franklin Award, even though the author is Australian. The reason for that being is that it does not depict in any way the Australian way of life or use Australian characters. So there's the first thing to say about this particular book. Anyway, so this is the author's third novel, following After the Fire, A Still Small Voice, in 2009. And then she won the Miles Franklin Award for her 2013 novel, All the Birds Singing. Now, I have to admit to having read neither of those, which is my fault, not the author's. So anyway, but getting to this particular book, this novel is told across three different timelines, all set near the small island of the title, which is a rock that looms out of the water near the Firth of Forth in Scotland. The first of these timelines is set in the present day and follows Vivian. Now, I'm going to call this Stream 1 because actually the author calls it Stream 1. But forgive me if I get a little bit technical here, but there's a reason why I want to do this. So anyway, so the first of these timelines set in the present day follows Vivian, that's Stream 1, who's an unemployed 40-year-old-ish woman who's come up from London to the family home near the rock to sort through the accumulated family belongings prior to the house's sale. The second, Stream 2, is set just after the Second World War, also in this same house, and features Ruth, who has just moved into the house with her widowed husband, Peter. So Peter had a previous relationship, a marriage. The wife died tragically young. They have two children. So they have two sons. They have two sons, and now Ruth is now the mother of these two sons, although not the biological mother, but the mother by marriage. And then for the third one, stepping back in time for the third stream, is set in the 1700s and features a woman by the name of Sarah, who is fleeing for her life after being accused of being a witch. Now, this particular novel is split into sections, with each section including chapters for each of the three streams as follows. This is rather a bit important, that's why I sort of put it up. And it goes Stream 1, Stream 2, Stream 3, then Stream 2, and then Stream 1 again. And it does that for each of the sections in this particular book. I didn't count how many sections there were. There's probably 8 or 10, I think, somewhere around like that. Now, each of these sections is followed by another small 2 or 3 pages detailing in rather graphic fashion a series of anonymous women being subjected to extreme violence by equally anonymous men. Now, this is a theme that's going to be running through this, so bear with us. Now, as the reader starts working their way through this book, they soon come to realise that Vivian is related in some way to Ruth. That the exact relationship didn't become clear to me until much later in the book. And Sarah is connected to the other two streams by appearing as a ghost in Ruth's house, and the same house, that's the same house that Vivian is supposedly clearing out. So she appears to both Ruth and to Vivian as a ghost, so that's the connection there. Tenuous, but anyway. Now, I make mention of these relationships because they're important to the narrative. They're not really sufficiently highlighted for the reader to be really sure about them at all. I kept having the feeling that I'd entered a conversation where everybody in the conversation in this group seems to know everybody else. And when they talk about what they've been doing, they say, oh, Jesse did this and Susan did that and I went down the street with Robin. And you're supposed to know who these people are. And I just didn't. And I felt a bit confused about this. And so I did what we don't normally do, but I felt as though I had to, was to start making lists of people and who they were related to, because I just had to keep track of things, the way things were going. And I didn't do a very good job of it because I started it too late and I didn't have enough time to go back and reread the book. So I was not being able to do it terribly well. But I just didn't get a lot of the interconnections between some of the participants. Also with this particular novel, I kept on wondering what it was all heading. I didn't know if it was a domestic narrative across different generations where a massive secret was going to be revealed, which is a standard trope, I guess, in that sort of role. Or is it a gothic novel where the ghosts of past family members and acquaintances will play an important role and increase the sense of growing unease and will come to dominate the narrative? Well, yes, that does happen, but mostly no. There are elements of both dramatic forms here, but neither can really run through to their standard, neither of them go through to their normal standard conclusions. Sort of are there and around, but they don't get to the end of where you think they think they're going to. That's not such a bad thing, but I just didn't know where this stuff was getting to. Now, the reader, well, this reader, me, I kept on hoping for some conclusion, some dramatic climax of some sort. But for me, it just didn't appear. You know, you sort of wonder what's going on. And the reason why I haven't gone very much into the drama and the plot about this is that I've pretty much given it to you. Basically, Vivian's there cleaning the house out. She has some relationships with her sister, who ends up leaving her husband. She meets this woman, Maggie, who seems to have appeared out of absolutely nowhere. And I've got some things to say about Maggie, I think, if that comes up. Ruth's having trouble. This is in stream two. Ruth's having trouble with her husband and the people in the town. She doesn't seem to fit into the community that's there. She thinks that they're all a bit strange. And she's worried about her husband possibly having an affair with somebody, which he then proceeds to gaslight her and say, no, you don't know what you're talking about. You're just, you know, making all this up. Maybe you should have a rest in a sanitarium. In other words, maybe I'll put you away because you're being stupid. Now, there's a constant theme through this, which is basically a sort of a description of toxic masculinity all the way through this. And this exercise in this particular novel is rather relentless in its determination, so that by the end you begin to wonder if there are any males in the novel that aren't basically totally self-centered, menacing and violent to women. They all seem to be terrible people. There isn't much in the way of male to female companionship in this particular book. No love in this book that I found. This is flicks towards it, but it just isn't there. There's no depictions of that. It's sort of like the males and the females when they're in a relationship are at loggerheads with each other the whole time. And I just kept on hoping that one of the males would do something nice, just anything, but they don't. Not one of them. And I get to the point where I start to feel a bit like a punching bag here, that I'd just basically been pummeled all the way right along. Now, that might have been the author's main aim here, to sort of really put the point about toxic masculinity, but oh God, it got a bit overpowering in the end. And I don't know whether she's achieved anything new here. I just think that she said, well, this is it. This is what they like. You know, all men are shits, basically. And he's like, well, hopefully not. And I just sort of got to the end of this and I thought, so? I was disappointed. I didn't get to the ends that I thought that it wanted to, and it just seemed to fade out. So I only gave this one a 3 out of 5, David.
Well, that's very interesting, because I gave it 5 out of 5.
Yes, I know, which is why
it's... well, because I liked it a lot. But, I mean, yes, it has an agenda, and the agenda is... The agenda really is how women have to deal with toxic masculinity in minor and major ways, from this just the sort of constant gaslighting that Peter does to Ruth. Peter's her husband, and the fact really he's really picked her to marry because he wants a nanny for his kids. That's really the whole reason. So no, there's no real love lost there between those two. So there's that sort of constant minor, you know, just male entitlement, and then there's the as you say, the actual violence that occurs. Like the very beginning of the book is a prologue, where a child is walking along the beach, and she comes across with her mother, doing, you know, picking seashells and things. And the child comes across this suitcase, and inside the suitcase, she sees a human hand poking out, fingers poking out. And then she sees an eye, and someone's actually chopped up this woman and put her in this suitcase. So it's a really gruesome beginning. So, you know, she sets the scene that way, you know, for the whole book. So there's no question that that's what she's doing. She's looking at, throughout history, if you like, how women deal with coping with men who behave this way. And unfortunately, a lot of men do behave this way. And so we've got to cope with that. And it's not, yeah, she says, not every man. And Uncle Christopher is quite nice in the book. Remember Uncle Christopher? He's Vivienne's uncle. So that's interesting. And I thought
the sort of uncle.
Yeah, sort of uncle. Because there is this peculiar relationship, this set of relationships in the book. And I actually drew up a family tree too, did, to try and work out who was who. But I think that's part of her sort of expanding out what you ought to learn about these people. And there are some really dramatic points in it. I mean, the actual most violent actual scene in the book, where you actually get it described, is actually women attacking, well, a woman attacking a man and killing him.
Yeah,
you know, and then you figure, but the reason for that is actually quite justified. You think, you know, this guy deserved that. So
you don't seem to get any consequence of that, though, do you?
Well, they hide it. I mean, Ruth and the other woman manage to dispose of the body, and they don't get found out about it. So, and that's kind of Ruth's turning point, where she shifts from being sort of this passive sort of wife to this bastard, to being, you know, sort of doing things on her own. So, I liked it a lot. I thought it's a pretty powerful sort of book. And it is,
but I think people have to be aware of the fact that there is a fair amount of violence to women in this. But it's interesting.
But that's the point of the book, isn't it?
I know. But they have to be aware of it.
Well, they do.
The interesting thing is, though, that it is written by a woman, so it's written from basically the woman's point of view.
Absolutely.
And it can be tough reading. Some people will find it fairly tough reading.
One of the interesting things I thought was the fact that third strand, the one that said a long time back, which I actually thought was probably Middle Ages, a bit earlier than you suggested, it's actually done from the point of view of a boy. It's the boy and in whose father, who's a priest, who rescues Sarah, the girl, and he, it's kind of seeing from his point of view why he eventually comes to carrying out violence against Sarah. Because he's afraid of her magic, her witchcraft, and what she's doing with it. So I don't know. Well, look, it's a matter of personal taste, but I liked it a lot, and I thought it was a very powerful sort of book. And anyway,
there's a heck of a lot in this book to discuss.
Oh, look,
absolutely.
I was thinking about the book for a whole week after I finished reading it.
I'm not. I think she's a wonderful writer at the sentence and chapter level. I just wonder whether it goes anywhere. You know, sort of. I mean, I do like there to be. I don't want things just to fade away at the end. And I felt this basically gets to the point where it sort of fades away. I kept on thinking, you know, something's got to happen. So, okay. That's just me.
That's fine.
That's my point. Anyway, so there we go.
That's okay. Yeah. Fair enough. We all have different takes on things, and that's a good thing. We have different takes. All right, so I'm going to talk about a book called Notes from the Burning Age by Claire North, who's, as we've discussed a few times on the podcast, we're both pretty big fans of her writing. And so I was looking forward to this, which is her latest novel, and I wasn't disappointed. So, how to describe it? It's set in a future age in which humanity is slowly recovering from environmental catastrophe, a time called the Burning Age. And legend has it that powerful spirits, I don't know how to pronounce this, I'm going to make a guess, powerful spirits called Kakui? K-A-K-U-Y. How would you pronounce that, Perry?
Kakoi.
Let's call it Kakoi.
I kept on thinking it was Kakoi, but, you know, it could be anything. Yeah. It was K-A-K-U-Y.
Yeah, that's right. Kakoi, let's call it. Okay, so legend has it, these spirits called Kakoi awoke and inflicted terrible punishment on mankind for its disrespect of the planet and its ecosystems. The whole face of the earth has been altered by this catastrophe, and most religions have been replaced by temples which give respect to the kakoi and thanks for the blessings that earth confers upon us. No one actually worships or prays to the kakoi, however, as they're said to pay us no more attention than we do to an ant, unless we commit heresy and try to return to pre-catastrophe technology. So mankind fears the anger of the kakoi. So with that as a background, we follow the fortunes of a man called Ven. It's the first person protagonist of the book, Ven. And we start off with him as a child. He lives in a small village at the edge of a regrown forest. And he's out playing with a little girl called Vey, who's his own age. And they're playing in the forest, and they get to and climb the kakoi tree, which is where villagers bring offerings to the kakoi. Now, Vey's sister, Yue, who's a few years older, she trails behind. She's been told to look after her little sister, you know. She's, you know, down, down, look after this little sister. So she's pretty resentful about that. But the two younger kids climb the tree, and while Ven is high in the tree, he suddenly realizes that everything's gone silent, and then he starts to smell smoke. So what follows then is there's a fire in the forest, and what follows is the dramatic flight of these three children as the forest goes up in flames again, and they eventually plunge into a river to escape the flames. And while they're in the water, Ven looks up, and amidst the flames, he believes that he sees a huge figure in agony being consumed by fire, one of the kakoi dying. And then in the strong current of the river, young Vey is plucked from Ven's grasp and she's swept away to drown. So this experience, which really, you know, the older girl, Yue, feels terrible guilt at not being able to protect her sister, and Ven sort of feels guilt for not being able to hold on to her. And that the relationship then between Ven and this slightly older girl, Yue, continues throughout the book in different ways and becomes a kind of key point of the plot of the book. So we then shift a couple of decades later. As an adult, a young man, Ven is working in a bar in a place called Vien, V-I-E-N, Vien, in a province called Maze. So there's not so much countries as provinces. And while he's in the bar, he's recruited rather forcefully into an organization called the Brotherhood by a gangster-like character called Jorg, without the E on the end, who has high political ambitions. Now, after some time, Ven becomes Jorg's personal assistant. Eventually, Jorg becomes the force behind the scenes of a humanity party, which is determined to literally unearth the technological knowledge of the ancients, the secrets of the Burning Age, and put them to use again. But to the priests of the temples who venerate the kakoi, this is a terrible heresy. So most of the book is set in what is now continental Europe and North Africa, and we don't hear much about places outside that area. I don't think America ever gets a mention.
Once, okay. I think it just gets mentioned because it's... I remember it because it's spelt with a K.
All right, okay. Well, there's some interesting little satirical stuff like that in there, because there's also an amusing sort of snarky little bit about those people who are living in what was once Britain, who have cut themselves off from Europe and built a massive seawall around their island, and they shoot refugees on sight. Just you get this little glimpse of this. Anyway, at the start of this process, Maze is the only province trying to break the rules and apply ancient technology. Now, the other provinces push back against Maze, but fear that they will be forced to follow suit and dig up this technology in self-defense. And eventually a terrible war begins. Now, Ven's role as Jorg's assistant places him at the heart of this conflict. But Ven isn't all that he seems. And what follows is an exciting story of betrayal, escape, punishment, and release. And so this novel is kind of less of a work of cautionary science fiction, though it does that very well, than a terrific spy thriller. And I think comparable with John le Carré. I thought this was a great book. I think it's a major work of science fiction, and I would hope and expect to see it on next year's Hugo ballot. But whether it will be or not is another matter. What did you think of it, Perry?
I agree with most of what you have to say, except for the espionage part of it.
All right.
Maybe I've read too much to Carrad, but I picked who the mole, because he's basically got, there's basically information going backwards and forwards between the Brotherhood and the other organisation, the Council, who are opposed to the Brotherhood. So there's information being passed backwards and forwards by moles within each organisation. And once it's revealed who the mole in the Brotherhood is, I thought, oh, okay. And then you find out that they're searching for the council. Search. They know that the council knows there's a mole in the council, but they don't know who it is. And so part of what Venn's role is within the Brotherhood is to try to find out and try to help finding out. And yes, it's ingenious the way you go about doing things, but well before it was, you find out who it actually is, I'd figured it out. Because I thought that it just couldn't have been anybody else. So I don't know. Is it a bit like reading a detective novel and figuring out who the murderer is, and then you think at the end that it's all revealed? You go, well, I knew that. So I'm a bit disappointed. I think maybe it is that. Yeah, but
I mean, in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, It doesn't take long before you figure out who the mole has got to be.
True.
And it doesn't spoil the story.
No, it doesn't. No, I agree. I think that from that perspective, that's true. I don't know. I just didn't... I know you'd give this a fairly high rating. I didn't give it as that high as some of the others of her work. I'm not sure why. I didn't find it quite as engaging, and I don't know why. And I do need to try and figure out why it wasn't as engaging as some of the others. I mean, like the first 15 Lives of Harry August I thought was just spectacularly good. This one, not so much. It may well end up on some ballots next year. I don't think it'll end up on the Hugo ballot, knowing what is happening with the Hugo ballots these days. I just don't think it'll end up there. Mm. Possibly things like the Clark or the British Science Fiction Association awards ballots, but
probably not the Hugo.
No, I don't. I can't think it'll be there in the Hugo.
Mm.
I just don't think it. It doesn't. It ticks some boxes, but not enough.
Okay, so, fair enough.
Oh, but the interesting thing was also, again with this particular one, I was absolutely convinced that, I don't know, I must have missed something at the beginning. I was certain that Venn was either non-binary or not a male.
He says that he's a little boy right at the start.
Yeah, okay, well, maybe that's what I missed and I sort of skipped over that. But there's a lot of things later on. There's at least one part in there later on where somebody asks him what gender he is and somebody quickly interrupts and says, no, that's not important here.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, hang on, what's going on there?
Mm.
So, you know, mm. I've got this point, I suppose, that when I'm now reading books by women writers and the main point of view character is in the first person, I tend to think right off, okay, the first person is a female. And I keep on being thrown out of it by finding out later on that, oh, no, they're actually male.
Mm.
Oh, okay, a bit like Piranesi. I was absolutely certain all the way right through the book until the very end that basically the protagonist was female.
Mm-hmm.
Because it fitted.
It could make be, any sense. Yeah,
because there was nothing in the book at all to tell you that was one, that they were one thing or the other.
Mm. Well, it didn't matter.
No, of course it doesn't matter.
Mm.
But the point, it doesn't. But I'm an old bastard.
You like to know. Well, I suppose if you're visualising the person in your head, you've got
to have some sense of them. Yeah, you're trying to visualise the person in your head. I mean, you want them to be a person. So you don't want them to be a... an amorphous non-entity.
No, fair enough.
And because you want them to be a person, I haven't got to the point yet where I can sort of say, okay, let's just assume that there's no gender at all. I'm still in that stage of basically saying, oh, well, it's either one gender or the other. That's a failing for me, and that's a failing on my part as a reader. And I have to get over that, but I'm just You know, I just thought it was intriguing. That's all.
Fair enough. Anyway, I liked it. Yes, so I've liked both of the books we've talked about this time. I probably wouldn't. Yeah, I guess I probably wouldn't. Wouldn't give Notes from the Burning Age quite as high a rating as I gave The Best Rock, but they're very different kinds of books. So anyway, there you go.
Yep.
All right.
Okay.
Do we want to move on to the Hugo ballot? This year's Hugo ballot.
Yeah, we've got a couple more books that we want to cover on this year's Hugo ballot. And that'll pretty much, there's only one left for
one
us
left.
To do. Mm. And I'll probably be looking at that next time. Is the Tamsin Muir Harrow the Ninth. I was going to be reading that for this week's episode, but when I realised it was 500 pages, and I thought I didn't quite have enough time to get through it. So
this is a sequel, isn't it, to the previous one?
That is. The Harrow the Ninth is a sequel to Gideon the Ninth, which was on the ballot last year. I think it was last year.
Yeah.
It was on the ballot previously. But I moved over to a book called Black Sun by Rebecca Roanhorse, and that's also on the ballot. So I thought, well, I can fit that one in, and I was slated to read that one anyway, so I just read it early.
Sure.
Doesn't matter. We get there in the end. Now, this book, Black Sun, by Rebecca Roanhorse, is a fantasy novel. It's the finalist for the best novel for the 2021 Hugo Award. It was also a finalist for the Nebula Award and the Locust Award for best fantasy. So there's a number of people that have given it a bit of a tick. I don't believe that's on the World Fantasy Award ballot, final ballot, but this is an interesting. Very, very interesting novel. Now, Roanhorse won the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer back in 2018. And as you'll recall, this is now referred to and known as the Astounding Award. But at the time that she won it, it was the John W. Campbell Award. And so that's what she won. And she also won the Hugo and Nebula Awards for Best Short Story also in 2018. So she came on to the... came into the field with a bit of a bang early on, picked up Best New Writer Award plus two major awards for short stories, but she hasn't picked up any awards for any of the major awards for her novels as yet. But if this is anything to go by, she's getting better and better. Now, this novel is the first in a planned series which is going to be called Between Earth and Sky. You would normally think there's going to be three, but who knows? You never know with these things. They could keep on going on forever. And she set up a world in which, yes, it could keep going on for quite a while if that's what she wants. Now, this series of fantasy novels is, according to the author's afterword in the novel, based on pre-Columbian cultures of the Americas with elements of Polynesian and Mayan mythologies and cultures thrown into the mix. It's a pretty heady brew, and it's rather interesting. And I'll say a bit more about that a bit later on. Now, we're talking about different storylines and timelines again, David. This novel is the story of four people. Serapio, the man who's destined to become a god. Shiala, always pick on names that are difficult to pronounce. X-I-A-L-A, Shiala, who's a woman of the mysterious Teak people, and who's also an exiled sea captain. Narampa, who's a female priest who has climbed out of abject poverty to the highest ranks of the religion, as referred to as the sun priest. And Okeo, who's a warrior prince of the Carrion Crow clan. Now, we follow these four storylines in rather jagged fashion, bouncing backwards and forwards between each, and also backwards and forwards on each of their timelines. But early on, you get the idea that all these will come together as they're all dated as being a certain number of days or years before convergence. And that's a capital B, capital C. So this convergence is a mysterious event that we only find out about later in the book, but it hangs over the whole of this particular novel. Now, the novel starts in fairly violent and harrowing fashion 10 years before convergence, as you read of Serapio's mutilation at a very young age at the hands of his mother, she is convinced that her son will become a god, the new god that the world needs, and sets him on his path by cutting his skin into the forms of the Crow clan. This is a standard way that you find out that they mark themselves. So instead of actually tattooing, what they do is they actually cut the skin to leave scarring, so that the scarring is there in forms of wings on the back, but also as a motif at the bottom of the throat. It's fairly brutal, and you know, I think they would rub things into it to make sure that the scars actually stayed up and didn't heal completely properly. So there's that mutilation. But she goes on a bit further and sews his eyes shut, blinding him in the process, of course, because this is what she believes is required for him to become a god. Now, immediately after this is completed, because it's done in a room in the family's castle, she jumps out the window and commits suicide. Because the father is attempting to break down the door, which he to stop her doing this, which he finally does. But by the time that he has got through the door, the son is blinded and his eyes have been completely sewn shut. So that's a fairly tough way to start this particular book. Now, Serapio's storyline then follows him through his childhood. He's about 12 when this happens, and so he's 10 years before the convergence, so he's going to be about 22 when the convergence occurs. And his timeline follows his upbringing in his father's castle, in his training in weapons and fighting, and his initiation into the secrets of the clan. He's treated pretty brutally by his tutors here all the way down the line, who keep beating him because he's blind and say, well, you've got to learn, don't you? So I'm just going to belt you until you figure it out.
Okay.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So he's fairly well brutalised through most of his life. Now, Zia's storyline starts 20 days before convergence and immediately intersects with Serapio's as she is engaged to take the young man across a treacherous sea to Tova, which is the main city on this particular continent, and home to the Watchers, which is the overriding religious body of the land, headed up by the Sun Priest. So you have Narampa, that was mentioned earlier. She is the Sun Priest, so she's the head of the Watchers. And the Watchers are sort of like, if you like, the whole overriding religious clergy that looks after the interactions between the people and the clans below them and the gods or the god. Now, that Sun Priest that I just mentioned, Narampa, is in trouble with the other Watchers in Tova, who resent her climb to the highest rank and who are plotting her downfall. She came from poverty, whereas they all came from privilege, but she was the apprentice to the previous Sun Priest, and he saw something in her that nobody else did, and he brought her up, and then just before he died, he anointed her as his successor. And of course, all the others who are really ambitious just didn't like that very much. So they basically plot to get rid of her. So lastly of the four, the warrior Akeo has only just returned to the city from his studies to attend the funeral of his mother and to act as advisor and protector to his sister Issa, who will now resume her mother's old rank. So you've got all these four different streams, two of them which have come together very, very rapidly. So in essence, you've almost got three that are basically all coming together. And we eventually learn that convergence is actually a solar eclipse. Black Sun, makes sense, which will coincide with the winter solstice, which is a fairly portentous event, which only occurs every 400 years or so. So something, it's not really spelled out early, you build up to it, but the reader gradually becomes aware that something momentous and possibly very bad is going to be happening on this particular day. I mean, Serapio is heading towards the spot where all of the watchers and everybody is going to be making a big ceremony on the day of the winter solstice under the total eclipse of the sun, where things are going to happen, and they do. Now, Rowan Horse, the author here, handles the various streams of this epic fantasy with a deft touch, lingering just long enough on each of the storylines to give you enough information so you'll have maybe just one chapter on that particular storyline, or sometimes two running in together before moving on to the next one. And it's all a matter of building up the tension and the drama as she goes with each particular chapter. And it works really well. I'm not exactly sure that she handles the ending as well as she might do. It seems to have come on really quickly and then it's all over. I can understand one reason for it, but I can't tell you why that is, because that would give away the ending. Mm. And I don't really want to do that here. But anyway, look, I think she handles it pretty well. And it's really a pleasure to read a fantasy novel that's not smothered with these usual faux European mythic tropes, most of which have been pinched from Tolkien and manipulated and stuffed about. This is far better. There's a lot more. There's a lot more interesting things going on, and people transforming from, you know, humans into mer people and back again, and various creatures and giant birds. So giant birds have been a bit of a thing that I've been noticing lately, and so this is a bit of a footnote to the overall review, and that's interesting to see how she utilises these the crows in this particular novel. The Carrion Crow is, of course, a clan who are associated with the crows, and as we know, the genus Corvus, which includes the crows and ravens, are very, very intelligent birds, and lately you've been able to read about them with George Martin, with his crows in his Song of Ice and Fire sequence, and also the Anlecki's ravens in the Raven Tower. So it's interesting that there's been a number of these particular things. Here, the crows are the size of the giant eagles in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. Okay. So people are actually able to sit on the back of them and ride them, which they do. But they are a very important part of the storyline, and they're handled very well. So I was impressed with this. Bit down on the ending, but other than that, I gave it 4.0 out of 5, which I thought that was pretty good.
Hmm. Okay. It doesn't sound like a book that would appeal to me, I think. And I certainly don't like that faux medieval fantasy. That is definitely the kind of fantasy I really dislike. But even what you say about this one makes me think, doesn't quite appeal.
Some of those fantasies are okay if handled properly. But sometimes you just think, oh God, not this day.
Well, yeah, it just bores the heck out of me.
Yeah, you're better off just keeping the subject matter to one particular part of things and just burrowing into that, and then that's not so bad. But it's a lot of that stuff, that sort of faux European stuff's all been done.
Yeah.
And every time you come up to you go, oh, not this again. Mm. But this is a bit different. And the story really flows. The story really flows. And apart from that early part of the violence to the young boy, which is a bit harrowing in the first chapter. I get we've had a bit of violence here today.
Yeah, we have.
Which is a bit disconcerting. But apart from that, until later on in the book, it flows pretty well. Yes, there is some violence, but it's not massively bad. Although there's a lot of threatened violence here, mm-hmm. that doesn't get fulfilled. But I enjoyed this, and I'll actually be looking forward to reading the next few books in this series.
Very good. All right. Well, the Hugo nominated novel that I'm going to talk about is called The City We Became by N.K. Jemisin. So I have to say from the start that this book annoyed me in several ways. Despite that, I suspect that it's highly likely to win the Hugo Award, so what do I know? I kind of want to like it. It's certainly entertaining, and it kept me reading, which is all good. And it has some interesting characters and some good action sequences, so there are good bits to it. The problem is that I just can't swallow the basic premise of the story, which is that eventually human cities reach a point where they are born. It's not clear to me what this actually means or what it is which triggers this event, but the conceit of the book is that there's some kind of process during which a particular individual from that city is transformed into an avatar of the city, and the city is born. And now it's the turn of New York, the first American city to reach this point. So we start with a young black man, a graffiti artist or a mural painter, a bit like, you know, the urban artist Banksy. He's being advised and supported by an older man called Paolo. And the young man has recently taken up, he's been painting all sorts of things all over the city, but he's recently taken up painting huge mouths on rooftops around New York. And Paolo approves of this, telling him that now the city breathes easier. Eventually, we discover that Paolo is, in fact, the avatar of the Brazilian city of São Paulo. He tells the unnamed protagonist about the enemy, an evil entity which attacks cities when they're at their weakest, which is just after they've been born. Sure enough, the enemy arrives in the form of a tentacle monster and attacks the young avatar. There's a big fight, with the avatar of New York calling on the power and resources of the city that he somehow controls. And though the enemy manages to destroy a major city bridge, the avatar beats it back. However, he's badly damaged by the struggle and falls into a deep coma. All of this is in the prologue. Now, we then meet a man arriving in the city centre by subway. As he comes out onto the street, he realises that he's forgotten his own name and the name of the college he's supposed to be there to attend. So he has a kind of fainting fit, and as strangers help him up and ask who he is and what's his name, he glances up and sees a sign reading Manhattan. And he tells them that his name is Manny. Very bewildered by all this, and he somehow, without going into details, he gets a lift to an address that he finds in his wallet, and he shortly in this cab finds himself fighting off an outbreak of white fronds which are sprouting from nearby cars on the highway, which are kind of attacking them. And he climbs onto the roof of the cab, and it smashes through these white fronds. The white fronds, it seems, are a manifestation of the enemy. A little later, Manny encounters the enemy again, but this time manifesting as a woman in white, a Caucasian woman who transforms before his eyes into having pure white skin, hair and clothing. Still not sure what's going on, he fends her off. So we've got several different points of view to deal with in the book. Manny joins up with a woman called Brooklyn Thomason, and she's a black woman who used to be a rap artist, but who's now a middle-aged city councillor. Together, they start to realise that they have become avatars of the boroughs of New York. He is Manhattan, and she, of course, is Brooklyn. And they begin to sense that there are others out there, and that the avatar of Queens is in dire danger, so they head off to help her out. The avatar of Queens, it turns out, is a young woman immigrant from India, who is also attacked by the enemy, but she manages to push it back before Manhattan and Brooklyn arrive. Then we get the point of view of Bronca, who's of Native American descent, who runs a community arts gallery. She, of course, is the Bronx, and she has her own disturbing encounter with the woman in white. But we've talked about four people so far, but there are five boroughs of New York. So what does that leave? The remaining borough is Staten Island, represented by a young woman of Irish descent called Aislinn. Get it? Staten Aislinn? Yeah. Anyway, Aislinn's father is a cop with the NYPD, a deeply conservative, misogynist, racist, and controlling white man who dominates his daughter. Aislinn, too, is approached by the woman in white, but this time there's no fight, as the woman in white pretends to be sympathetic to Aislinn's problems, and Aislinn starts to treat her as a friend. So when Aislinn is approached by São Paulo, the avatar of São Paulo, and the other avatars of the boroughs of New York, she violently rejects them. She actually attacks São Paulo and damages him badly. So we have this ongoing battle between the avatars of the boroughs and the enemy, which keeps on manifesting as, you know, white tendrils coming out of people's necks, white fronds coming out of sewers, or embodied by this woman in white. The avatars must discover the location of the avatar of New York, the young black artists we meet at the start. So these are the individual boroughs, but there's also the avatar of the city as a whole. Now, he is lying somewhere still in a coma, and they all need to get together to wake him up and destroy the evil plans of the enemy. But without Staten Island joining in, it appears they won't be able to do it. So look, again, I acknowledge my white privilege. I know it's impossible to fully take that into account. But here we have five major characters, all of whom are people of color. The Avatar of New York is black. Manny is mixed race, but says that he identifies as black. Brooklyn is an African-American woman. Bronca is Native American. And Queens is an immigrant from India. All these people make up the team of the good guys. I mean, this is my term for them, the good guys. And the only bad guys are the Caucasian Aislinn, represented in Staten Island, and the enemy, who manifests as whiter-than-white woman in white. It's a bit heavy-handed and obvious, that's all I can say. I just think it's a bit much. So what else annoyed me about it? I'm not nearly at the end. What else annoyed me? Well, we're told in Chapter 11 that when a city is born in our universe, it punches through neighbouring universes, destroying them in the process, killing off trillions of sentient beings in those universes. Now, when the Burrow Avatars find out about this, they sort of stand around for a bit, think about it for a few minutes, and Queens thinks about shedding a tear, but then they all kind of shrug it off. It's kind of, oh, well, too bad. Let's get on with our day, and off they go. I find that very hard to swallow. Another annoyance is that in Chapter 12, the woman in white tells Aislinn about how awful cities are, how terrible they are, and filthy things, and that there are no cities in her universe. The chapter is literally titled, They Don't Have Cities There. The motivation of the enemy is said to be to destroy cities. Yet by the end of the book, we find out that the woman in white is in fact the avatar of an enemy city. So it all just seems incoherent and confusing. So I don't know. I just didn't believe in the basis of the story, and I don't feel it says much about real people in the real world. So while, as I say, parts of it are entertaining enough, and it's reasonably well written, I just couldn't get it as the novel as a whole. It just didn't do it for me. So it wouldn't be one that I would vote for, I'm afraid. So there you go, Perry.
Yes, well, I haven't read it yet, but from the bits I've been seeing about it, I wouldn't be at all surprised if it gets up.
It'll get up.
I mean, thinking back to the her Broken Earth trilogy, the first the Broken Earth trilogy by the same author that won 3 Hugos in a row. The first one was, it was a decent novel, and I was okay for it to win the Hugo Award. Second one I thought was a bridging novel, and it got up. I know it was not really a very strong year, but it got up. And as soon as the second one got up, I thought, oh, it doesn't really matter. The third one's got it won. And of course it did. And I would not be at all surprised if this one wins as well. It's almost a matter of, oh, well, she's written a novel, therefore we're going to vote for it, rather than the quality of the novel itself. Mm. So there are enough people that are voting who think along those lines to probably get it over the line. Mm. And that's just what's going to happen. Mm. So
look, she's a good writer, I think. You know, the actual quality of the writing is good. The story rolls along. It sucks you in right towards the end. I don't have any trouble getting through it. It's just, it just doesn't make sense to me as a thing.
And that's quite fair enough. Now, I know that some people might say this, a lot of things that you guys read about don't make sense. I mean, you know,
but it's got to have relevance to portal.
Yeah, it's got to have relevance within the story.
It's got to have relevance to the real world and real people. I think unless it does that, I quoted this in the recent Ann Zappa contribution. Philip Pullman, who wrote his Dark Materials series, basically says, you know, if it doesn't, fantasy is a tool to reflect upon the real world. If it doesn't do that, it's a load of old cobblers. And that's my feeling about this book. It's a load of old cobblers.
Right. It seems to be running an agenda.
Mm. Oh, yeah, for sure.
It makes some
valid points. And it makes the valid points of how people of color are treated by white people. There's no question about that. But it's just, it's very heavy-handed, I think, and it could have been much more effective if it had been more subtle, I think.
To just basically throw a spanner in the works, it sounds like my view of Bass Rock.
Yeah, well, okay.
That it just seems that there's an agenda here, and that everything has to be, all of the scales aren't level, and that's fair enough. But when it gets to the point where everything is on one side and there's nothing on the other, you get to the feeling not exactly even-handed or realistic, from my view.
Mm.
But
anyway,
we shall differ on those.
We'll differ on that. Yeah.
That's right. But I can see your point of view here about this Jemison novel, but it'd be interesting to... I will get to read it in the next month or so. So
see what you think.
I might just do a catch-up on some of the ones that you've read and just do a quick run-through and sort of say, this is what I thought, 5 or 10 minutes, just to basically go through them and let you know what I thought of them.
Sure.
But other than that, we're now down to just the one novel that I was mentioning that's left, that's Harrow the Ninth, which I shall read and we shall get to next week. At this stage, from what you've told me about the books that you've read, the Relentless Moon and The City We Became, I'm still tending towards Piranesi by Susanna Clarke as my top pick. I don't think at this point, even from Black Sun, I don't think that and the stuff that I've read, I don't think that either of the ones, anything else is going to knock it off. But we'll keep on going and see how we get to, because Harrow the Ninth is still there. You never know. You just never know, David.
You never know.
It's the voyage of discovery, the things that you don't know what you're going to come across, which is good.
Which is why you read, yeah.
That's why we read. That's right. Yeah. And we almost don't know what we're going to be discussing next week, other than Harrow the Ninth.
Figure something out.
Something about what books we've been reading or something along those lines. But in a couple of episodes, we might have something a little bit more specific that we might talk about if we can get through the reading. So we might go back to the Hugo Time Machine for 1967 in a couple of episodes. Not entirely sure just then when it's going to be yet. There's a bit of reading for us to do to catch up on. Well, there's always reading for us to do, but hopefully we can get through that. I'm not going to read as much for 1966 as I read for 1965. I read quite a lot for that, and I'll just get enough in the 66 to cover our discussion
good stuff. Yep.
But until then, David?
I think we're pretty well done.
I think we are well done. Yep. All right.
All right.
In that case, we shall see you in a couple of weeks in the next episode, David.
Indeed. Thanks very much.
Stay well and keep reading.
Indeed, I will.
Okay. Thanks.
No worries. See you then.